Next case of the morning is number 06-2588, Abstract and Title Guarantee Company against Chicago Insurance Company. Good morning, Mr. Moore.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Moore, on behalf of your plaintiff appellant, the Abstract and Title Guarantee Company, Inc., with me today as co-counsel is Tom Brodnick. Your Honors, Abstract and Title is the insured under a policy of insurance issued by Chicago Insurance Company. And that policy places a duty on Chicago Insurance to defend and indemnify Abstract and Title for claims and lawsuits that arise during the policy period. The issue today is whether the initiation of an interpleader lawsuit satisfies and absolves Chicago Insurance of its duties under the contract. We're here because the district court ruled that it did. Abstract and Title respectfully disagrees. Now, the policy in this case contains four specific mechanisms, and only four, by which Chicago Insurance can absolve itself of its duties to defend and indemnify Abstract and Title. It can do so by exhausting the policy limits through the payment of judgments, through the payment of settlements, third, through the payment of damages, or fourth, through the payment of claims expenses. Those are the four and only four means. In this case, Abstract and Title submitted claims and forwarded lawsuits to Chicago Insurance Company and demanded indemnification and defense. Rather than defend or indemnify Abstract and Title, Chicago Insurance initiated an interpleader lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana, naming Abstract and Title and a number of other parties as defendants. In essence, Chicago Insurance sued its insured, Abstract and Title. Now, nowhere in the policy will we find the term interpleader. Nowhere in the policy will we find the phrase tender policy limits into court. The policy is completely devoid of those terms. And I ask that the court be mindful that this policy was drafted by Chicago Insurance Company. Therefore, it's strictly construed against it, construed in favor of Abstract and Title, and we must look to the reasonable expectations of Abstract and Title under the policy. Now, as I said, interpleader is not one.
How exactly did Abstract and Title suffer under the interpleader?
It suffered in a number of ways, Your Honor. The first claim was received by Abstract and Title in September of 2002. That was forwarded to Chicago Insurance Company. The first lawsuit was filed against Abstract and Title in April of 2003. That lawsuit was forwarded to Chicago Insurance for defense. The day before that, the answer was due to that complaint, Abstract and Title called Chicago Insurance and said, "The answer is coming due. We need a defense. Your duty is to defend." At that point, Chicago Insurance simply instructed Abstract and Title, "Get an extension, go get yourself counsel. We're going to interplead these funds. We are no longer helping you in this matter." And that's what they did.
Well, they're helping you by putting $500,000 into the custody of the court.
And they ultimately did that in September of 2003, a year after the first claim was filed. Then that lawsuit, the interpleader lawsuit, was pending for 2 years. And during that time, Abstract and Title, per the instructions of Chicago Insurance, filed a request with the district court for payments of its attorney's fees. At that point, the interim costs were $160,000. In October of 2004, we're now 2 years after the first claim, the district court denied Abstract and Title's motion for payment of its attorney's fees. And in doing so, the district court said, "Well, this interpleader action is now a matter of equity. And since it's a matter of equity, the district court is going to hold on to these funds and distribute them on a percentage basis of the claims." Well, Abstract and Title, when it paid its premiums year after year to get a defense, it did not bargain for an equitable matter. It was a contractual matter. Chicago Insurance turned it into an equitable matter and then opened the door to a number of other parties to that fund.
So your view is that your client had the right to determine where that $500,000 was going to be expended, on what case?
That $500,000 should have been used to defend Abstract and Title in the lawsuits. That's what Abstract and Title paid its premiums for, so that when it was sued, there would be money there to defend it. And that money was not there in the time of need for Abstract and Title. Instead,
I assume what you mean is for the payment of attorney's fees and costs.
Yes, Your Honor. And then also for any settlements that did occur as well.
Well, but that's why I said where you're suffering from. So it's your concern that you're not concerned about more than $165. That went to pay some settlement, a little bit anyway. But you're out the $165,000, right?
And what happened ultimately when the funds were distributed, which was after Abstract and Title had filed suit against Chicago Insurance, was that Abstract and Title only received $120,000. And other parties then also received parts of that fund. And it didn't settle those matters. Two of the...
Well, let me go, get back. So you did get $120,000 out of that $500,000...
Yes, Your Honor.
Cool. So you're out $40,000.
Well, and it did cost us $71,000 to get any of that money. There was an additional lawsuit that Chicago Insurance placed a burden on Abstract and Title to defend itself in so that it would receive any money. And that lawsuit lasted 2.5 years.
But your idea is that they were obligated to defend you in every lawsuit that was related to this fraud or whatever it was.
Yes, Your Honor, to at least initially provide a defense for Abstract and Title. That's what Abstract and Title bargained for when it paid its insurance premiums. As I said, interpleader is not one of the four mechanisms in the policy where Chicago Insurance can terminate its duties to defend and indemnify.
Well, it is a legally available procedural device or remedy. The problem I have with your argument is that your interpretation of the contract essentially eliminates interpleader as a viable procedural device under these circumstances, because it's basically an argument that says, well, interpleader is unavailable until the policy limits are exhausted, so the insurance company has to pay its policy limits down to zero before it can invoke interpleader, in which instance there would be no reason to invoke interpleader.
Yes, interpleader, there is a statutory interpleader. There's also, as we heard earlier this morning, statutory arbitration. But the parties here have the freedom to contract. Chicago Insurance wrote this contract and determined how it could terminate its duties to defend and indemnify. Had it wanted interpleader to be included in that, it simply needed to add it. It could have been the fifth criteria to terminate its duties, file an interpleader action. But it didn't. Interpleader doesn't give it the magic out of its duties under the contract. This is a contract. Abstract and Title fulfilled its obligations, paid its premiums. When we look at the duties of Chicago Insurance Company, they don't include filing an interpleader.
Why?
That's a defense.
On what legal basis would the insurance company have to preserve its statutory right in the contract in order to avail itself of it? I don't understand that.
Well, if we look at it in the realm of, say, a declaratory judgment action, if that had been filed, in that realm, if you file a declaratory judgment action, you're still defending your insured from the lawsuits while the declaratory action is pending. In this case, Chicago Insurance never received any discharge through the interpleader. It was still bound to Abstract and Title. It just chose that avenue. And by doing so, it took this from a contractual matter to an equitable matter. Chicago Insurance's duty runs to Abstract and Title and Abstract and Title only. It doesn't have duties to those other claimants that it defines as claimants. And like I said, it had the option. It could have added that in the contract, and it did not. The other cases that are cited talk about payment of that the duty to defend continues until the policy limits are exhausted through the payments of settlements or judgments. And in those cases, it was found that you had to defend until you paid settlements or judgments. In this case, there was no settlement, judgment, claims, expense, or damages paid. And it certainly, Abstract and Title did not receive what it had bargained for when it paid its premiums.
Well, it's your claim then, from what you just said, that they had a duty only to you, no obligation, direct obligation, with regard to the people who were ultimately compensated.
That's correct. The Your Honor, the record, there's nothing in the record that shows any of these other parties made any claim to Chicago Insurance Company. None of those parties that sued Abstract and Title made any claim to any insurance proceeds that Chicago Insurance was holding. They only got involved in the game when Chicago Insurance took Abstract and Title's defense funds and put it in the hands of the district court and made it an equitable matter. And I see that my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. We'll hear now from Ms. Reed.
May it please the court, my name is Laura Reed. I'm with Riley Bennett and Egloff, and we represent Chicago Insurance Company. This case involves a unique type of insurance contract which had limits, and within those limits were both the indemnity obligation and the defense obligation, so that once the limits of $500,000 were paid to either in claim expenses or to pay judgments, settlements, or damages, the duties under the contract ended. There's no dispute in this case that claims were presented against the insured, ATG, and that those claims were 96 different claims, and that the value of those exceeded $15 million. There's never been any dispute by ATG that the claims could have ever been defended and settled.
I guess to cutting through it, as it came out a little later, their position is that the indemnification duty didn't run to those claimants, but ran to Abstract.
Well, the indemnification provision, the policy says that the insurance company will pay amounts that the insured owes to those other people.
Doesn't that indicate that you'll pay it to Abstract for them to then?
The policy is not an indemnity policy in that respect, in that they get to control where the money goes. If there is a judgment entered against ATG or a settlement on behalf of ATG,
right. But does the money go? I understand.
Then the money would go directly to the claimant.
In other words, you would pay if you have a settlement agreement or if you have a judgment. CIC would pay that money to
whoever the claimant was, not to ATG to then cut a separate check to pay the judgment, the settlement, or the damages, or the award.
Their point is that they seem to feel that as the party that contracted with you, they have the right to the first cut, if you want. It first goes to taking care of the attorney's bill and whatever's left.
And they had the opportunity to try to convince the interpleader court, and there were two actions. There was the interpleader action, which concluded with an agreed order, an agreed award, and then ATG turned around and sued Chicago in a separate action.
Was that first action in the same district court?
It was in the same district court in front of the same judge, although they filed the second action, the breach of contract action, in state court, which was then removed to federal court and placed within the same court, Judge Tender's court.
Do you argue res judicata or collateral estoppel at all in this action?
The district court basically found that because the claims of breach had not been raised in the interpleader action, and should have been if they were going to be, and that they probably would have been improper in the interpleader action, that they could not then be raised later. And the district court...
He says that there's that possibility, but is it fair to say that his holding in this case is on that point?
The holding is based in part, I think, on the fact that they did not bring any breach of contract claim in the interpleader action, and probably couldn't have, because case law says merely by filing an interpleader, you are not breaching your contract. The interpleader statute is a mechanism for allowing insurance companies who are presented, just as in this case, with multiple claims against a limited pot, to have the court say, what's the fair way to divide up this pot? And the Tashire case, which is a Supreme Court case that has been cited in the briefs, clearly says that it is appropriate to file an interpleader in a case where an insurance company who insures an insured for liability, and there are numerous claims against the insured, and the limits are not going to be enough to satisfy all those claims. That is an appropriate mechanism to avoid the problem that arises when you have a race to judgment. If Chicago had paid defense costs and the first claimant who made a demand within policy limits, then what happens to the rest of the claimants? And the bottom line is that there was $500,000 here. ATG got the benefit of that $500,000. If Chicago had paid more in defense costs up front, there would have been less to pay to settle all the claims. And there would not have been any difference at all in the ultimate result. $500,000.
That's why I asked counsel what the injury was, what they suffered. I think you indicated, one of you indicated anyway, that was determined. There was a determination as to costs, fees and costs made by the district judge.
The district judge in the interpleader action actually did award defense costs to ATG. They got $120,000 out of the amount that was interpleaded. The other critical point here that's a fact from the insurance policy language itself, if Chicago had done apparently what ATG wanted it to do, which was to continue defending it, and had decided that it really needed to pay to interplead the limits so that the claimants weren't having this race to judgment, if Chicago had continued paying defense costs, interpleaded the $500,000, there's a reimbursement provision in the contract that says that ATG has to pay Chicago back for any amount over the $500,000.
So it's
any way you cut it.
Conceivably you could have eaten into the five, or taken the whole $500,000.
Correct. Any way you cut it, they were entitled to $500,000 for the payment of defense costs and for the settlement of claims, and they got exactly that. There's a comment in their reply brief, I think, that says the claims were not there. They didn't get the settlement of claims, and none of the claims were settled, and that is not true. The agreed order that was entered into specifically says that several of the parties were releasing ATG as a result of the award made out of the interpleaded funds.
Did ATG argue in the interpleader action that it was entitled to the full $500,000 policy limit?
No. What it argued was that it was entitled to defense costs as they were incurred, and the judge said the contract does not require that. And having that firm order that interpreted the contract, not really in equity, the court's order in the interpleader action, first looked at what does the contract require, and the court said the contract doesn't require defense costs to be paid as they are incurred. I'm going to wait until we can decide the equitable part. How can we divide up this pot so that it's fair to everybody? And what ATG claims in this case is that seeking fairness and equity for all the parties involved was a breach of contract and was bad faith. And that simply is not the case. Seeking fairness and equity for all involved is not either a breach of contract or bad faith, according to case law. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, just one question. I wondered, where did this take place? Was this in Fort Wayne? Or where was the fraud being perpetrated?
I believe it was in Indianapolis in Hendricks County. It was centered in Hendricks County.
Over how long a period?
It was, I know that they knew, and this is in our briefs, I know that there was some issue with the particular employee that was diverting funds inappropriately in 2000 and then by 2002 or 2003, and opposing counsel probably has those dates.
That's not important. I was just curious.
And actually, I think it all resulted in some criminal action being brought against a developer.
There was no time remaining, so the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both attorneys.